The show is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. On our program today, coming up, we will be exploring a few what you could semi-accurately call extinct instruments in the world of classical music. Instruments called the baritone, spelled B-A-R-Y-T-O-N, as opposed to other kinds of baritones, which are not extinct. Arpeggione, gamba, not really extinct, still often performed, and something called the heckelphone, the latter of which I don't even think I've ever seen a picture of, although that may not be the case. In any event, violist Kate Lewis with pianist Paul Borg and another colleague or two are going to be presenting a program for these extinct instruments, although not on those instruments. Wednesday night at Illinois State University, we'll hear all about it coming up later in the hour. First up, though, we will have some actors from Parkland College Theater. They're presenting a play called Murder by Natural Causes, which opens on the 11th and runs through the 22nd. At Parkland College in Champaign. We'll have a couple of scenes to preview that. More very shortly on Live and Local. That was a group called the Honeydew Drops from their CD called These Old Roots and the song called Amaranth here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly, and I'll be with you until 1 o'clock. First up on our show, we have actors from Parkland Theater. They're presenting a play called Murder by Natural Causes, which will open on the 11th and run for a number of performances through the 22nd. Parkland College is in Champaign. And with us are the director and a few of the actors to give us a bit of a preview of the show. The director is Abigail Mannikin, and we also have Monty Joyce, Randy Offner, and Zach Benner, who are going to give us a preview of a couple of scenes. I was reading the description of the play, and it's not altogether clear to me whether this would be a crime play, a comedy, a tragedy, some mix of all those things. I mean, the title sort of suggests a comic element to it.
It's a little bit of both, or all, actually. I think that that's what makes it a really unique piece, is that there's something to appeal to everyone. And I really can't tell you too much about the plot, but it's a really great suspenseful piece.
But you have to tell us something about the plot, otherwise no one will want to go. or at least I could just send you all home right now.
Well, I can tell you that there is a woman named Allison Sinclair, who was married to a man named Arthur Sinclair, played by Monty here. And she is a very greedy little girl, as she says. And she takes a lover, played by Zach over here, and they plan to kill her husband. They plan to kill Arthur by scaring him to death because he has a pacemaker. that's why
it might not be that difficult to do.
Well, you'd think so.
Oh,
you'll see. You'd think not, but there are a lot of things that get in the way. One of those things is the fact that Arthur here is a mentalist, or a psychic, or ESP. You dress it up in a bunch of different ways. But he has his ways that he knows exactly what's going on with certain people, but maybe not with others. And you always wonder if he will see what's coming.
Yeah, you can't get too much by me, really. Can I read minds? Maybe.
Well, you could say that about any mentalist.
True.
They have television mentalists.
Exactly.
Even shows about them, and it's not clear that they're really doing anything.
But they're entertaining.
But it makes for a good show, and I guess that's at least part of the, well, that of course is the point of putting up one of these shows. Is this a show, Abigail, that you chose for the season, or were the shows already chosen and then you were asked to direct or you put in to direct? I don't really know what the process is for Parkland.
That one specifically was kind of a combination of different things happening. I knew that they were looking for directors, so I asked very nicely if I could be considered. I'd worked at Parkland briefly before the season beforehand, and I was in conversations with the artistic director about what the season was looking for, and one of those things was a suspenseful murder-type show that was a crime show or a thriller show, and we had a number of options that we were exploring. We read a bunch of different scripts, and this one we pulled off the shelf and we said, this one sounds really interesting, actually. So the cards just kind of came together. Is that a phrase? Things all came together, and I think it worked out really well, and I'm really lucky that they let me have that opportunity, and I've been really fortunate to be working with such a great staff and cast and crew over at Parkland. They've been very welcoming.
So in other words, you were signed on to be a director without knowing yet what you would direct.
Kind of, yeah.
But got to participate in the process. Mm-hmm. When you say pulled off the shelf, do you mean literally this was
literally a
play that was sitting on someone's shelf and said, oh, this looks interesting?
Literally, we were sitting in the costume room, and the artistic director, Randy, she kind of walked over to the shelf and literally pulled the script off of the shelf and said, read this.
Was it one that she knew?
She knew of it. She was looking for it at the time. We were also considering an Agatha Christie staging. We were considering a couple of other things, but she had known that this one was in the library, and so she gave me a stack of things to read.
Have you done enough research to know who these playwrights are and what are the things they've done? Richard Levinson and William Link?
I know that this was originally, I think it was a TV program that they then,
right,
that this was readapted for the stage by a man named Tim Kelly. I'm not entirely sure of the author's previous works.
But they did go on to produce and write for Murder, She Wrote later. This was like in the late 70s. The play was in the late 70s, and then they went on later to do Murder, She Wrote. So they know what they're doing.
Apparently, well, at least when it comes to murder.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. We can't answer that. You can't answer this question. But I was going to ask if the play, the name of the play implies that a murder is in fact committed, but I guess if we could tell the answer to that, there'd be no reason for people to go.
You'll have to just come and
see.
Not
so much. Well, okay, so we know that Arthur Sinclair, played by Monty Joyce here, is the guy everybody's trying to do in, including his loving wife.
My duplicitous wife, that two-timing... I don't...
So-and-so.
Yes, she is a so-and-so.
And then Zach Benner in the role of Gil Weston is one of the people trying to commit this murder.
Trying.
And then Randy Offner, who spoke just a moment ago, in the role of, I can't read my writing, Eddie...
Oakman.
Yep. Is that what I wrote?
Mm-hmm.
I guess so. It doesn't even look like that. Who are you?
I'm a private investigator friend of Mr. Sinclair's.
Oh, So Mr. Sinclair has some idea that something's afoot, or is it really obvious?
Mr. Sinclair relies on Eddie, his private detective, to help him know what he needs to know to do his stage act and other things in his life as well. Again, we can't give too much away, but yes, Eddie is it's made it pretty explicit. Eddie is the man that gives me the information that I need to live my life and perform my tricks, so to speak.
Yeah, so to speak. If somebody's digging up your information,
exactly.
We know how that goes around, doesn't it? Well, I know you brought a couple of scenes in to give us some idea more than what we're able to talk about, which is always the challenge about theater, to talk about a play without actually hearing how it's put, because you can describe the plot, but it all really comes down to how the playwrights write about it, what kind of voice they give to all the actors and so on, and what's the tone. So somebody set us up for the first one we've got here.
I guess I can set it up for you if you want. Eddie has come in with some information that Mr. Sinclair needs in order to impress a future employer, in order to secure a gig, basically.
In his mentalist capacity.
In his mentalist capacity, yes. That is primarily what Eddie does. And that's how Arthur does his act. We see this pretty early on in the play. What happens is that we have Eddie and Mr. Sinclair having this conversation, and then immediately after, the woman about whom they're speaking comes in and Arthur impresses her with his psychic knowledge of her private life.
So the woman is, she appears in this scene?
She's outside the door at a garden party at that point.
And we are rushed for time because I need to get this information fast so I can impress, Mrs. Carrington is her name, and impress her that I am a man who knows what he's doing and can make her some money and win a gig for himself.
It's from Murder by Natural Causes, which will open at Parkland Theater in Champaign on the 11th of April.
Okay, if I sit?
Sit, stand, only hurry up and don't ask for a drink because you're not staying.
Got me a big bill on this one.
What do you care? I'll be paying for it.
Okay, here goes. this here Mrs. Carrington, she's having a gazebo built in the back of her house. Contractor's name is Schofield.
Got it. Keep going.
Oh, this is a goodie. Mrs. Carrington's got this mutt. Now, what do you call him? A Lassa Also, Lassa Alpo.
Close. Lassa Opso.
Anyway, his name is Toby, and she took him to the vet last week. He's an old dog, arthritis.
Is there a Mr. Carrington?
Nope. Widow. A husband was a surgeon.
What else?
She's always going on a diet and worries about her cholesterol count.
More?
She's got a niece who ran away and joined a cult.
What kind of cult?
Something called Children of the Flowers.
That cult was dying the day it started. I give it another few months. I'm still listening.
She loves TV soap opera.
Pass.
Her favorite food is baked potato with plenty of sour cream.
Kid stuff.
She made some big real estate investments a few months ago, and she worries about them.
Where?
Border country, Arizona.
She can't miss. Real estate value there has shot up handsomely in the past few weeks. So, does that wrap it up?
Yep, that's all for this one. If I had more time.
I did not know my wife is going to spring Mrs. Carrington on me.
Well, if you need me, you know where to find me, sir.
Thanks again, Eddie. I owe you one.
No, you don't owe me anything, Mr. Sinclair. I owe you.
Let's not hear that again.
People won't hire an ex-drunk. private investigator on the bottles. Bad news. If you hadn't given me a chance, I'd be down and out for the count.
I employ you because you're the best at what you do. You are being discreet.
Oh, you know me, Mr. Sinclair. I'm the invisible man. Now you see him, now you don't.
All right, so that's a setup. It really makes you wonder, or maybe makes you assume, what goes on, you know, in seances and all kinds of other sorts of so-called magical sorts of things that go on. We always assume that something is amiss, that there's no such thing as magic. But, Madi, in creating this particular character on the stage, are you... Did you have to, or did you feel that you ought to go out and find out a little bit more about your type of person? You know, what do mentalists really do?
I decided that I didn't want to. I really just wanted to create this character from whole cloth and just let it come out naturally. I mean, the mentalists I do know, people like David Blaine and Chris Angel, they're more new wave, new age type. That's not the word I'm looking for, but anyway, they're a little bit too edgy. I think Arthur Sinclair is more of an old-fashioned, without being stuffy, more of an old-fashioned classic mentalist. But I talked to a local mentalist named David Der Geist, and he gave me a list of the most prominent mentalists who are now working in the United States and said, well, check it out if you want to. And I will, but I'm going to wait until I have actually done the show because I've already developed the character and I don't want to confuse my mind and give more impressions that will just muddle my head. So But I do look forward now. This has actually piqued my interest in what mentalists do and how they do it, and both in terms of performing and in terms of getting the information they need to perform. So,
what interested you about this role before you auditioned for it?
What really interested me about this role is how theatrical and how incredibly smart Arthur Sinclair is. He's a very cagey man, and I think that those character traits are character traits that I could convey. Yeah, and I looked at it. It's a real challenge, too, because there's quite a difference in the tone between the opening scenes and then the last act. Quite a difference in tone.
He sounded just as you depicted him right there, and this can be difficult because you're not actually doing it on the stage and never know how a microphone in front of you affects things, but as sort of a very cool kind of person who just absorbs quickly and then mentally moves on to the next thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and he has to be. I mean, a skittish person, a person who is nervous and a person who is not very assured is not going to become a world-famous mentalist. You just have to have a performer's instinct, and you also have to have a real ability to read people and absorb information and then use it.
Monty Joyce in the role of Arthur Sinclair in Murder by Natural Causes that is opening at Parkland Theater on Wednesday. It'll continue through Sunday the 22nd, and Abigail Mannikin is directing the show. Is this how many people are in this cast? It sounds like it could be a small ensemble cast.
It's 8 people. There are 4 men and 4 women.
And in casting it, just looking at the 3 people who are sitting here, I'm guessing that 2 of them are not students at Parkland. And 1 of them maybe.
We were very lucky that we got Zach, who was also a student at Parkland. He's very mature in his role, and I was pleasantly surprised at the caliber of talent that we got from a lot of the Parkland students. We have another Parkland student named Stephanie Senior, who is in the show, and she plays Jessica Prescott. But we were very lucky with the cast members that we got. I think each of them came in, and immediately I thought, aha, that is who I want.
Which is nice when that happens. Mm-hmm. I guess what I was getting at with the question is the notion that Parkland Theater, although it's based at Parkland College, is not necessarily a college theater. It's a community theater that employs a lot of students.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Employees meaning en route to their associate's degree.
They're a great bunch of students over there. They comprise our tech crew and our stage managers and all of our backstage crew. They're all very bright and eager students who are trying to learn kind of what it takes to be in the theater and to run this business. So I really like this kind of environment that is welcoming to both community people and also is an educational environment for the students at Parkland, because I think that when you can work with people who are maybe outside of your age range or outside of your range of experience, that's when you really grow and that's when you really learn. So I think that Parkland is a really provides a lot of good opportunities on both sides of this of the spectrum.
You said that you were involved with something at Parkland before. What's your background that brought you to doing this show?
To
directing theater at all?
Oh, goodness. What brought me to Parkland was that I directed a one act in their Festival of One Acts that was in the fall of last season. And I was very lucky because I'd actually just moved to Champaign maybe a couple weeks before I received a tip from a friend that they were looking for directors for these one acts. And that got me introduced to the Parkland scene. Before that, I've worked in theaters and I have done almost everything, almost every role in a theater except for costume design. I think I made a mental list at one point. I like directing because it's one of the more collaborative roles. I like actors. I admire actors. I do like to act, but I'm not very good. So I like to be on the other side of the table because while I can't really do it myself and I admire those who can, I feel like I can maybe help them do what they need to do.
You realize you're reinforcing that horrible adage, those who can't teach.
Yeah, that's kind of what it's looking like.
Which has never seemed to be very fair, although, you know, I think that there's plenty of instances where that's the case. You find that you can't necessarily do something that well yourself, but you recognize the skills that it takes to turn somebody into, fill in the blank, a fine student themselves, into an actor, into mm-hmm. a musician. You know, I've heard of, I actually know some people who coach opera, for example, who can't sing.
Goodness.
You know, either at all or very well, but they're musicians and they can coach, et cetera. But in any case, I dwell on that. I know you have another scene from how much farther into the play?
Well, this one is in the second act, and we have gone past the moment where Arthur here has impressed Mrs. Carrington with the knowledge that he has acquired. And now we are back in the house. It's a little bit later. And the lover, Zach, comes in. And this is kind of the moment where he's starting to ramp up the intensity of this exchange because he's really trying to scare Arthur to death.
So I presume we've had some instances of scaring so far.
It's one longer scene where Zach enters unannounced. Excuse me, Gil enters unannounced and slowly starts to reveal pieces of information that a reporter who he is posing as would not normally know. And it escalates rather quickly, actually. And it ends with a bang. Ha! That was quite literal.
That sort of assumed so. Yeah. So Zach Banner in the role of Gil Weston, and I presume that Arthur is in this scene?
Yes, it is a two-person scene. He has come into my house, and he has told me that he is a reporter, and he's interviewing me.
Here we go, from Murder by Natural Causes. It'll be at Parkland Theater starting Wednesday.
You know, it's funny that you should mention that, because I get the feeling that there's a gun in this house. Am I correct?
Yes.
See? Isn't that strange? Here, let me see if I can get anything else. It's a 38? No. A 22 in the upstairs bedroom.
Now, just a minute. How did you know that?
I've got you, don't I?
What?
Your wife told me. We got to talking the other day when I scheduled the appointment, and she mentioned that there were a lot of robberies in the neighborhood. So I suggested that she could get a gun.
And she told you that we already have one.
Yes. She didn't seem too happy about having it in the house, though. You know, I think that may be how you do it. Read minds. Just pick up bits of information on the sly.
Don't think me rude, Mr. Weston, but I really must get back to my work.
I really am fast to catch on. I'm a quick study.
What are you doing?
I thought so.
Stop that.
4 CDs. 1 for each suit in your card deck. As soon as I pick my card and tell you what it is, you go over here, pick the track, and your recorded voice tells me what card I chose.
Get out. Now.
Don't I get a chance to show you what I can do? For instance, upstairs in your bedroom, there's also a red and yellow quilt.
What?
Pillowcases with your monogram on them. Let me think. What else? A green chair and a dressing table.
You went through the house before you came in here.
Not even close. Okay. I'll let you in on my secret. A couple of months ago, your house was in one of those decorating magazines.
You looked at the pictures.
Exactly. Simple when you know how to read minds, isn't it?
Wait a minute.
I'm one step ahead of you. You remember that there were, in fact, no pictures of the bedroom in that magazine. Maybe I am a mind reader.
All right, Mr. Weston, you've had your fun. Time to go.
But I haven't finished my demonstration.
That's what you think.
You're going to miss the best part.
If you do not leave, I'm calling the police.
But the best part is about your wife.
What about her?
Name's Allison. Quite attractive. I believe she worked at an art gallery when you met her.
You could have read that anywhere.
True. But where would I have read that she has a birthmark on her lower back? A birthmark she doesn't like people to know about.
How did you know?
I saw it there.
That's a lie!
Is it?
Ooh. Right. Well, that's from Murder by Natural Causes, and it would sound like we're getting into the crux of a number of different things here. Zach Banner in the role of Gil Weston, posing as a reporter, so an actor acting the role of an actor.
Yep.
I guess.
it was definitely an interesting put together when I got this role, because I am, in fact, an aspiring actor. I'm actually going to school at Parkland to gain an associate's degree in theater arts. And it was interesting because Gil Weston is also in his actual life in the show an aspiring actor. And you learned that earlier in the show. So it was an interesting fix.
Yeah, I imagine. So you get to play yourself.
Yep.
More or less.
We might find out soon that actually you're an actor playing Zach Benner, playing Parkland Steve, playing this role.
And we do have Monty Joyce playing Arthur Sinclair, and I don't think any further complications than that, other than involved in his character. Randy Offer in the role of Oakman.
Yep.
Still can't read my writing. And Abigail Mannikin, who is directing Murder by Natural Causes. It opens at Parkland on Wednesday, continues for performances Friday, Saturday of this week, 7:30, and then next week, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 7:30, and then there's a Sunday matinee on the 22nd. At 3 o'clock. For more information, go to theater.parkland.edu. And I'm glad you're all able to come in today and give us a little sample of this piece. It sounds like a fun show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. And you are invited to see Villages, Castles, and Manors from Masterpiece and Mystery and more in England and Wales for 14 days beginning September 27th. If American history appeals, you can board WYLL's Civil War train, private vintage train cars leaving for the southern battlefields with historian Anthony Pitch, September 7th. Information on these tours is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel, or you can phone 217-333-7300. Our broadcast today is made possible with support from these business partners: Busey Bank, Bates Commodities of Normal, Inuka Incorporated of Fairmount, and A-Plus Farms Limited of Pine Village. These business partners join the Friends of WYLL in making great programs possible, and we thank you for your support. Coming up next, violist Kate Lewis, who will be speaking of impersonations and so on. She will be impersonating various extinct instruments on a recital with pianist Paul Borg Wednesday night at Illinois State University, and we will hear about those instruments coming up very shortly. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. That was music by Joseph Haydn, performed by the Haydn Baritone Trio, and that's spelled B-A-R-Y-T-O-N, and I make a point of that because there are at least a couple of other musical baritones that I know of. One, of course, is the singer of the voice type of which I am an example when speaking anyway, and also when singing. And then there's the instrument that is closely related to the euphonium, which is a brass instrument. Those are spelled, of course, B-A-R-I-T-O-N-E. This was a performance of Haydn's 67th baritone trio. This particular instrument, and I should say that the baritone here played by a fellow named John Sue, and this instrument is a stringed instrument, but not of the usual stringed variety. We'll hear a little bit more in a moment from Kate Lewis, who is a violist, not a baritonist, although she will be impersonating a baritonist, as well as an arpeggionist and a gambaist and a hecklephoneist. Or no, I suppose she's not doing that particular impersonation, along with pianist Paul Borg for a recital that they're calling Music for Extinct Instruments. That'll happen on Wednesday night at 8 o'clock at Illinois State University's Kemp Recital Hall on the Charles W. Boland Faculty Recital Series. And as that name implies, Kate is on the faculty at ISU. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
So where did you dream up this notion of a recital for extinct instruments?
Well, it kind of came about in a sort of backwards way. Paul Borg and I have played several recitals over the last 6 years at ISU, and the Hindemith Hecklephone Trio had been on our short list of pieces we wanted to play for this past 6 years. And since Paul is sadly retiring at the end of the semester, we thought, gosh, we better get that Hecklephone Trio out there before too long. And then the next piece we kind of came to in agreement was the Bach Gamba Sonata. We've played the first and the third one, but we've never played the second one, and have really enjoyed working with him on a harpsichord and viola collaboration. So with those two pieces, it kind of made sense to keep exploring these unusual instruments. With gamba, hecklephone, we added the arpeggioni sonata to that. And then I kind of realized that Haydn has 126 trios for viola, baritone, and cello. And why not arrange the trios for two violas and cello? And it works quite well, actually.
So baritone or baritone is, you know, I said it's a stringed instrument, but it's unusual in that you bow some of the instrument, some of the strings, but there are other strings that vibrate.
Yeah, well, there's 9 to 20 extra strings, so there's 6 regular strings that you bow, and then there's between 9 and 20 plucked strings that can either be plucked or sympathetically vibrate with the instrument. So it's kind of a viol-harp hybrid instrument, and it's actually quite difficult to play because you often have to produce both the melody with the bow and the harmony, the left thumb playing the bass line.
If you're actually playing a baritone.
If you're actually playing a baritone. Yeah.
So in this case, as the viola is going to be taking what part?
The baritone part.
And then, so is it just you and Paul?
Actually, it's two violas and cello. This piece does not have keyboard in it.
So what is the other violist doing?
He's playing the actual viola part.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. So there's, oh, all right. Well, it says here, right here in this recording, we have a baritone and a viola and a cello part. So we're just doing without the vibrating
exactly.
strings.
Exactly.
But you can do it with the melody.
The range is very similar.
So, well, that's not so bad. Well, we have an example. You referred to the Arpeggioni Sonata, and this is a pretty famous piece by Franz Schubert that is never played anymore on the original instrument. It's played on a variety of other instruments, including can be viola and I think cello. And who else plays this piece?
A lot of different people play it. I've found arrangements for, clarinet and even trombone. So there's a lot of people that play this piece. The piano part has also been transcribed for guitar, so there's a lot of different options. But the arpeggione itself was a very short-lived instrument. It really had about a decade-long existence where it was kind of popular, but never gained widespread popularity. So the Schubert's Sonata is really the only well-known piece written for the instrument.
And it, what does it look like? I'm not sure I've ever seen a picture of it.
Well, it's kind of a guitar-viol hybrid. So it has frets. And its body is shaped kind of like a guitar. It's held between the knees and the lap, just like the arpeggione, like the baritone. And it's got six strings and, like I said, shaped like a guitar or an early fiddle. We're shaped kind of with an hourglass shape.
But held between the legs as a cello would be. Mm-hmm. So three of these instruments, the gamba, would have been held that way, the arpeggione and the baritone, which we just heard. Well, we have a sample of you had to go to your LP collection, because we don't have one here, which sort of surprised me, of the Schubert Arpeggione Sonata played on an arpeggione. And the keyboardist here, who is not a pianist, is, do you remember what instrument they're playing on this one?
It's piano.
It is a piano? Yeah. Regular old piano. Okay. Well, here we go. This is the actual sound of the arpeggione, and then it's the second instrument you'll hear. Of course, the piano sounds like a piano. And then we'll have it played a little bit later on the viola. You're listening to Live and Local. So there we heard an instrument, well, two. One of them a virtually extinct instrument, and the other one an obsolete instrument, the arpeggione, which was the stringed instrument. I'm actually looking at a picture here, which really does look kind of like a cross between, I'd say, between a guitar and a cello. That's the virtually extinct instrument, as Kate Lewis said, it's one that has such a short period of 10 years or so of any sort of popularity in Schubert's day. And he wrote this sonata for it, known as the Arpeggione Sonata, even though it's virtually never played on that instrument anymore. And then the obsolete instrument, here identified as the Hammerflügel in German, which is a forte piano, which was the precursor to the pianoforte. And honestly, I've never really been clear on what exactly made the transition. But in any event, we heard Alfons Kontarski playing the pianoforte and Klaus Stork playing the arpeggione. Kate Lewis will play this piece with pianist Paul Borg, except Kate will be playing the viola that sounds something like this. Kate Lewis herself playing right here in our studio. Her recital will be on Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. She'll be joined by a fellow Illinois State University faculty member, cellist Adriana Ransom, and then graduate student Andrew, Francois, as the second viola on the piece that we sampled earlier. Well, one of the pieces we sampled earlier, we heard one of Haydn's baritone trios, and she'll play presumably a different one than the one I happened to play. That would have been something if I'd have guessed out of 160-some.
126. Yeah. We're playing 113.
You're playing number 113, yes. Not 113 of them. Yeah, that recital will be at 8 o'clock on on Wednesday. So do you have to know anything about how the arpeggione was played in order to play this piece, or do you just play the notes on the viola?
Well, there's several different editions for viola and piano. So many, many people have gone to the original arpeggione part, which incidentally wasn't published until long after Schubert had died, and the instrument was completely obsolete by then. So there's many, many different editions. What I've done is kind of looked at all the different published editions available today and picked and chosen the bowings and fingerings and some of the octave displacements that I want to do to make it better fit for my instrument.
And why do you think the viola is a good substitute for the arpeggione? Is it obvious from the range?
It's the range mostly. I mean, it's also a bowed string instrument. It's the range of the piece. Fits very, very well on the viola. Cellists often play it. It's very high and quite difficult on the cello. It's not that it's easy on the viola, but certainly kind of fits our range a little better, I think.
So a natural fit for you. And then there's this instrument, the viola da gamba, which is not really an obsolete instrument because people do play this with some regularity in the period instrument world.
Indeed, yes.
Although not true really for the other two instruments that we've sampled so far.
Well, the gamba family was in existence with the violin family for quite a long time. The 1600s, the gamba was really in the 1500s, the gamba was really more in vogue. But by the 1730s, when Bach wrote these three gamba sonatas, it was becoming a little bit old-fashioned. So the gamba family actually refers to many instruments of different sizes, just like the violin, viola, cello, bass of the modern violin family.
But you'll be duplicating the gamba that looks most like a viola or that we would typically see looks like a cello.
Right. The instrument would have been held in the lap like a cello, but it would look like a small cello.
Ah, so I have probably seen this play. But we have a sample right here of, is this the one that you're going to be playing?
Right.
The second one,
in D major.
Of the gamba sonatas by Johann Sebastian Bach. We heard Jordi Savall on viola da gamba and Anton Koopman who was on this show not long ago, as a matter of fact, playing the harpsichord in the second of Johann Sebastian Bach's Gamba Sonatas, which will be played by violist Kate Lewis on her recital once tonight with pianist Paul Borg, sounding something like this on the viola. And that sounds like a reasonably direct transfer. Do the additions have to change pitch, or are you at the more or less the same pitch as the viola da gamba would play?
I'm also at the same pitch. I think that they're using Baroque tuning in this recording we just heard, and I'm using modern tuning.
So you're just playing a little higher
exactly.
than Jordi Savall did.
Yeah, there's also, like in the Arpeggioni Sonata by Schubert, there's a few octave displacements that I have to work around and figure out. But again, for the most part, it works very, very well on the range of my instrument.
Meaning you might have played something a little higher or probably a little higher than lower?
Yeah, it's just changing it by an octave one way or another.
So if a cellist plays the viola da gamba music, they, in this case, as opposed to the arpeggioni, they might be playing it a little more directly? Or might they have to do some as well?
They have to do some octave displacement too. The range is kind of in between the modern viola and modern cello.
Which is how they get played so often on both.
Yeah,
on
and
both
they're great
instruments.
Pieces. So.
I wonder, do violists and cellists ever get together and play, all right, you'll play these octaves and I'll play these octaves and we'll pull it all together?
No, although a few years ago, a colleague of mine, my colleague Adriana Ransom, and I put together a recital where we did all three of the gamba sonatas, and she played cello on the first one. We brought in a gamba player to play gamba on the second sonata, and then I played viola on the third one.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then then did you have people vote? Which did you like the best?
No, then we played Brandenburg 6. So
with all three of them together?
Just the sixth concerto, which has two violas and two gambas.
Oh, how convenient. So, oh, well, that's really very nice. That would have been
a fun
recital. You have to recreate that and let me know what has happened.
All right.
And then we're finally going to end up with this instrument in a moment called the Heckelphone. Let me say first, though, that tonight at 7 o'clock on our evening concert, you can hear Johannes Moser soloing in Dvorak's, conveniently enough, cello concerto with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, Manfred Honeck conducting, also waltzes, polkas, and songs by the two Johann Strausses. That's tonight in our evening concert at 7 o'clock with the Pittsburgh Symphony. And our broadcast today made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information at 217-244-9309. This is 90.9 WYNL-FM and HD Urbana. With translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. We have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector, the first-time buyer. Wine tastings on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. And we have just a moment to say that you have this instrument called the Heckelphone, and I gather that Paul Hindemith's sonata for Heckelphone involves a viola.
Indeed. Heckelphone, viola, and piano.
And a Heckelphone is... What the heck is a Heckelphone?
It's a bass oboe. It's an octave lower than the oboe. It's about 4 feet long, rests on a little peg attached to the bell on the floor, and uses the same fingering as an oboe. And obviously, we're not playing a Heckelphone. There's actually not that many in existence any longer. Only about 150 were produced, and of these, only 100 of them are believed still to be around. So saxophone players actually play this, and I'll be joined by my colleague Paul Nolan on saxophone.
Paul Nolan. This recital for extinct instruments will be Wednesday night at 8 o'clock at Illinois State University's Kemp Recital Hall in Normal. Thanks to Kate Lewis for joining us on Live and Local.
Great. Thanks to be here.